This morning, we shall begin by dealing with the Monroe Doctrine briefly. The Monroe Doctrine was promulgated on December 2, 1823, by President Monroe. He was influenced in this act by his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. The reason for the promulgation of the Monroe Doctrine was the recent independence of a number of Latin American states. They had broken away from Spain, and there was some fear that attempts might be made to restore them to Spanish rule. Spain at this time was a decadent empire, inefficient, incompetent to a great extent, and unable to do anything to restore its own power over Latin America. There was some fear, however, that the Holy Alliance of Russia, Prussia, and Austria might move against these newly formed states in order to try to subjugate them once again to Spain. The problem at the time was that the powers of Europe were very deeply disturbed by the recent events on the continent, the French Revolution, and the aftermath of the French Revolution. Their fear was that any kind of independence movement would lead to a worldwide desire on the part of people to find independence of their rulers, their monarchs. And so they felt that whatever their personal differences, it was necessary for the great powers, the monarchs, to come together to oppose any move anywhere in the world by any people to overthrow the power of an empire or a monarchy. They felt there was a dangerous current abroad of revolution, and hence their desire to move against any group that had declared its independence of Spain. There was thus a very real problem. On top of that, one of these three powers was Tsarist Russia. You will recall that yesterday, when we dealt with the fact of the number of flags that have flown over California, we saw that one of them was Russia. There was some fear also that Russia would attempt to expand its powers along the Pacific coast. And therefore, the Monroe Doctrine was promulgated. Now, the Monroe Doctrine has, until fairly recently, remained as one of the cornerstones of American foreign policy. It does not have the status of law. It was never approved by Congress. There was no need to approve it. It was simply a presidential statement, together with his Secretary of State, to the powers of the world. However, although the Monroe Doctrine has never had any legal status, its power in American history has been considerable, in that it has been a summary statement of basic American policy. The Monroe Doctrine has, in essence, four main points. First, the The Monroe Doctrine declares that there shall be no future colonization in the Americas, North, South, and Central, by European power. Implied in this, of course, was the idea that any foreign power was barred from the Americas. At that time, there was no possibility of some Asiatic power being involved. So, in essence, the idea was the Americas belong to the Americas. But therefore, any attempt by Spain or any combination of foreign powers to interfere with these newly established Latin American states would not be permitted by the United States. Then, second, no attempt would be permitted to extend the European political systems to the Americas. Now, you see, this is a little different from saying that no European power will be allowed to colonize. What it in effect means that we were not going to permit their political ideas to be propagated and furthered in the Americas. To illustrate, this would mean, if applied in our time, that we would not permit, say, communism to take over any of the Americas. In terms of the Monroe Doctrine, we should not have tolerated Castro's coming to power, because it meant that a Marxist state allied to the Soviet Union now had established a beachhead in the Americas. The same would have been true during the 1930s of any attempt to establish Nazism or fascism in the Americas. This means, of course, that we've not been too strict about establishing this policy in recent years. As a matter of fact, as we shall see, to all practical intent, we have abandoned the Monroe Doctrine. But, first, no colonization. Second, the political systems of Europe cannot be adopted in the Americas or allowed to extend themselves to America. And third, we promised, however, that we would not interfere with existing European colonies. Thus, we said, we will not interfere with the British colonies, the Dutch colonies, the Spanish colonies, or any existing ones, so that any colonies that still remain belong to the mother country, and we will not interfere. Thus, in a sense, we were saying we recognize the status quo. Now, in a sense, we did not abide by this somewhat later. What did we do to interfere with one colony, one aspect of an empire? In fact, we went to war over it. Could anyone think of what war we fought with the European Empire to help free one of their colonies? Good, you didn't fail me. The Spanish-American War. Now, we had various excuses, and we won't have time to go into that, but we did claim that there were extenuating circumstances in that war, so that it was not a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And yet, it can be argued that in the Spanish-American War, we did not abide by our promise to avoid interference with existing European colonies. Then, fourth, in the Monroe Doctrine, we declare that we are not concerned with Europe's quarrels. If Europe is having a war and a quarrel, a division, we declared we are neutral to it. We are not involved, nor do we intend to get involved. This, of course, makes clear what we have done in recent years to the Monroe Doctrine. In World War I, we did get involved. In World War II, we got involved. In the Korean War and in the Vietnam War, we became involved in foreign affairs, foreign wars. And in our diplomatic policy, we have been involved in the Suez Crisis and in a number of other crises in recent years, where we are definitely concerning ourselves with European quarrels and with the quarrels of various powers of the world. So, to a very real degree, the Monroe Doctrine is now no longer operative. Not because any foreign power has violated it, but because the United States itself has consistently violated, especially the latter part of the doctrine, this fourth point. Yet, ironically, we have not abided by our pledge with regard to the second point. For example, Chile was taken over by a communist regime. True, it was voted in, but it was very closely allied to foreign Marxism. In a very real sense, it involved a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And yet, we abstained from action in the name of non-interference in foreign affairs, when at the same time we were involved in a foreign war in Asia. So the Monroe Doctrine, a very remarkable step in the diplomatic position of the United States, was undercut and to all practical intent nullified by the United States itself. This is why, although you know about the Monroe Doctrine, unless the country changes drastically in the next 10 or 20 years, your children may know very little about it. It may be a forgotten doctrine, dropped out of the history books because nobody is concerned with it. It's dead, and it is a part of our history that perhaps no one will bother to remember. This has happened to the Polk Doctrine. President James Knox Polk, P-O-L-K, who was president from 1845 to 1849, promulgated the Polk Doctrine. Now, it is important for us to deal briefly with the Polk Doctrine to understand what it means. We touched upon an important aspect of European policy and politics when we dealt with the balance of power. To review briefly, balance of power politics is that type of politics where various powers are determined that they shall have the ascendancy. They shall have the primacy on the continent of Europe. And if any other power begins to rise to challenge them, they will help a third power gain additional strength in order to attack the second power. The idea being that your rivals are to cancel each other out. We saw how Louis XIV used the balance of power, how Britain especially is the dominant force in Europe for some time, used the balance of power to destroy the old French monarchy, then to destroy Napoleon, then in World War I, or even after the destruction of Napoleon, to destroy Napoleon III when Napoleon III became very powerful, to destroy Kaiser Wilhelm and his German Empire, to destroy Nazi Germany after Nazi Germany had arisen to power as a result of their manipulation, and also to foster, with Churchill's famous Westminster College speech, the Cold War between the USSR, the Soviet Union, and the US. Now, the Pope doctrine is concerned with this balance of power politics. At that time, Texas had become an independent country. Territorially, Texas has more than enough power to be an independent country. It is bigger than many nations in Europe. But territory does not determine strength. Resources, industrial capacity, and other factors do. As a result, Texas, while technically an independent country, in reality did not have the ability to remain independent. Texas was mostly cattle, a small amount of farming. Its resources were limited. The government could not exist very well in those days in particular without foreign subsidies. Now, one of the interesting facts is that immediately Texas had all kinds of friends. As a matter of fact, Britain was ready to lend all kinds of money to Texas. In effect, what the British policy would have done would have been to make Texas more or less a branch of the British Empire to all practical intent without any violation of the Monroe Doctrine. Texas would have been so financially dependent upon Britain. The Texas policy would have been dictated by British policy. Texas would have been involved then in the balance of power politics of Europe. It would have meant that whenever Britain needed to exercise any pressure on the United States, it would have a lever right down in the southwest in Texas. This posed a tremendous threat. It meant that without colonizing and taking over Texas, Britain now had a tremendous means of using force against the United States, exercising pressure. Pope was immediately aware of the threat. Moreover, President Polk recognized that there was technically no violation of the Monroe Doctrine, so that he could not say to the British government, "You have violated the Monroe Doctrine and we protest." Of course, the British government could always say, "We don't recognize the Monroe Doctrine," and been accurate. But on the other hand, the British government knew that a policy of the United States that had been laid down as their basic policy with regard to the Americas. If they did violate it, it was going to mean some kind of conflict and trouble. But by financing Texas, by using this roundabout means, they were not violating the Monroe Doctrine. So Pope declared, as the Pope Doctrine, the other great cornerstone of American foreign policy in the last century, no country in the Americas can be involved in the European balance of power politics. In other words, not only are the European powers to stay out of the Americas, unless they already have a colony, but they cannot involve the Americas in the balance of power politics. That's the Pope Doctrine, very simply, but extremely important. Well, again, we destroyed the Pope Doctrine. We got ourselves involved in a number of things where the balance of power was at stake. Theodore Roosevelt was the first to do this. Does anyone know what war he involved us in without military action on our part, but to intervene to protect one country from defeat? To establish a balance of power. This is not an easy question. Do a little thinking. Theodore Roosevelt charged in as the peacemaker and saved one country that had won early victories from radical defeat and made a great nation out of it, when previously it had been of no consequence in the world. This was early in the 1900s. Yes?
Did he save Russia from the Germans?
No. You're partly right about one of the countries involved, Russia. What war was Russia involved in? Anyone think? I've given you half the answer. Doesn't anyone know? Don't you know? What? No, it was before, some years before. The Russo-Japanese War. Yes. The Russo-Japanese War. Now, what happened in this war? In the Russo-Japanese War, which was fought, of course, on the Pacific coast, the Japanese attacked Russia. Well, not necessarily the case, but the two countries went to war. And immediately the Japanese took the attack. Russia, because its center was in Europe, had a real problem in getting supplies to the Pacific coast. So, in the early stages of the war, Russia took one staggering defeat after another because it was so far from the battle line. Now, the results were quite disastrous to Russian morale as well as to Russian prestige all over the world. Russia was one of the great powers of the world. And here, a little far eastern country, up until now of no consequence in world affairs, was beating them badly. However, as the war progressed to a certain point, it became very obvious that Japan was going to be overwhelmed. Why? Because the Russians were slowly getting the men and the equipment across Siberia. And as they moved this vast amount of equipment and men across Siberia to the war front, it was clear now they were going to be in a position to overwhelm and to defeat Japan thoroughly. The great powers did not want this. Their attitude was that it would be nothing short of a disaster for Russia to defeat Japan and to have the door open to taking a big bite into China on the next go-around. And so their feeling was, we have got to do something there. We've got to prevent this Japanese victory from being turned into a defeat and a collapse. Therefore, some kind of interference should take place here. And so they prevailed upon Roosevelt, who foolishly felt that it was a great honor to be asked by the nations to play the role of a peacemaker, to step in there and stop the war before anything further happened, in the name of world peace. And so Russia was stopped by pressure from the great powers and the United States from going any further and turning a defeat into a victory. Since then, we have made the same very serious blunder, and we have saved a country from radical defeat. Does anyone know when this happened? This time it was the Russians who asked us to do it. This was not too long ago. We played peacemaker and created no end of trouble. Yes. Egypt, yes. In the Israeli war just recently, at the very first, things went badly for the Israeli because they were caught by surprise. Then things began to turn around. The Israeli armies were marching toward Damascus, and especially in Egypt. They had crossed the Suez. The Egyptian armies were in panic and in flight. Egyptian resistance was collapsing, and there was nothing to prevent the Israeli from overwhelming all Egyptian forces. So at that point, when we didn't fully appreciate, because we had such poor intelligence, we didn't fully appreciate how far gone the Egyptian situation was, we stepped in at the request of the Soviet Union and saved their friend Egypt. At that point, Kissinger was made into a total fool, and Nixon as well. Now, the only thing we gained out of it was that the Arab powers, instead of being grateful to us, promptly hit us with an oil embargo. So it was a thorough act of stupidity. And it was a violation of our historic foreign policy. So you see, yes. Not necessarily. If we sell them things on a cash basis, on an economic basis, we maintained that right to trade in the War of 1812. Now, there was another famous example in the last century of an attempt by foreign powers to violate both the Monroe Doctrine and the Pope Doctrine. And its real purpose was, in effect, to destroy the United States. Does anyone know what that attempt was? This is an extremely important thing. Very, very important. It concerned Mexico. What happened in Mexico during the Civil War? Yes.
Didn't they run for invade the U.S. from the war where some European countries couldn't take over the U.S. because it was so weak?
True. Now, who were they using as a front there? Yes, but what individual? Who became emperor of Mexico during the Civil War? Did I hear someone? Yes. Maximilian, good for you. Now, when we became involved in the Civil War, one of the immediate results was, of course, that there was a great deal of European support for the South. This support was not premised on any feeling of sympathy for the South or being pro-Southern. The whole point of the European support for the South and the hostility to the Union was, this young country, the United States, is getting too powerful. If we see it split, and if we help it to split, we will keep this country from becoming too strong. And possibly it will help us again to treat the Americas as an area where we can interfere at will. In other words, we can nullify the Pope Doctrine, we can nullify the Monroe Doctrine, we can treat the Americas as open country. As a result, when the war continued and it was apparent that there was not going to be a quick victory, that it was going to be a long, drawn-out affair, that possibly it could lead to Union defeat, the powers of Europe, Britain, France, Spain, Austria, and others, exclusive of Russia, this time Russia did not go in. The Tsar was pro-American, supported Maximilian of Austria. Maximilian was sent to Mexico with an expeditionary force of foreign troops to be made emperor. Now, Maximilian was a naive soul, and he sincerely believed what his foreign advisors kept telling him, the Mexican people love you. You're going to be the great benefactor of Mexico. They need a wise and intelligent ruler like you. As a result, later, when the foreign troops were pulled out, Maximilian was foolish enough to believe that the people there wanted him. Well, they wanted him to kill. So they promptly executed him. And his empress, Carlotta, who had taken the ship and gone back and went from one court of Europe to the other, pleading for help for her husband, lost her senses and lived insane the rest of her life. I believe she died in the 1920s, and this was in the 1860s. However, Maximilian was sent to Mexico with foreign troops. And the point was that he was to build a base there from which not only was there a threat to the United States, but if and when the war ended, a weakened United States could be very easily challenged by the foreign powers from Mexico with highly professional foreign troops. The threat was very real. As a matter of fact, in much of the Union, the feeling was that the country was finished. That irrespective of what happened in the war, with the South, which was underway. The Union was finished. That the European powers, through Maximilian, were going to destroy the United States. Now, there were good grounds for such fears. But what happened? Yes. Right. I think I discussed this once with you a few years ago. Yes. The Tsar sent the Navy to sea with sealed orders. One fleet, the Pacific Fleet, was told to go to San Francisco. The other was sent to ports on the Atlantic, Boston and, I believe, Washington, D.C. Well, consider what this meant when a great navy landed at both ends of the United States. The accounts of the day tell us that when the fleet landed, Americans in Boston, San Francisco, and elsewhere met the Russian sailors with tears. Women were going up and kissing the Russian sailors and crying, "We've been saved, we've been saved." And with good reason, they had been. The Tsar had actually saved America. And this instituted a period of very great friendship for a long time with Russia on the part of the United States. Because at a critical point in our history, when the foreign powers were ready to destroy us, the Tsar of Russia had come to our rescue. Now, when this happened, the immediate reaction of the foreign powers was, "We cannot do it, because we have a power behind us there, Russia, to the east of Europe, with its vast army, and we have the Russian fleet there, San Francisco and on the Atlantic coast." So they immediately gave orders to their troops in Mexico to withdraw. They withdrew, and the result was the collapse of Maximilian's government. He was urged by the foreign advisors to leave the country, and he said, "No, my place is here with my people. They love me." Well, he was immediately taken prisoner by them, and Juarez refused to allow any quarter to be given to him, and his execution took place. Now, there was another thing that Russia did for us at that time, and we did for them, apparently, as a favor. So it was to be a mutual favor, to indicate their friendship. Does anyone know what this other Russian act was? Yes. Yes, the purchase of Alaska. To indicate their cooperation and their feeling that the United States should have the future determination of this continent, Russia offered Alaska for sale to us. And we, as a favor to Russia, to indicate our appreciation of what they did, bought it. Now, even then, as you recall from your U.S. history, there were Americans who criticized what they called Seward's folly, to have bought that vast hunk of ice, Alaska, which turned out to be one of the greatest assets the United States had, the gold rush in Alaska, the fur, and so on. And now, of course, an even more important asset in terms of our present energy crisis, Alaskan oil. The wealth we gained there was enormous. And all of this is a part of the Tsar's feeling of the necessity of defending the United States. The extent of influence this had on this country was so great that even when the Russian Revolution took place, there were many people who were ready to be friendly to Lenin and his regime because the sentiment in America was intensely pro-Russian. Russia was our friend. That was the feeling. And indeed, in the last century, Russia did demonstrate itself to be one of our greatest friends. This in spite of the fact that we had, under Theodore Roosevelt, done Russia more than a little damage in the settlement of the Russo-Japanese War. Now we'll stop for a few moments for questions. Are there any questions? When does this period end, by the way? I keep forgetting.
10 of.
10 of. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.